The district recently overhauled its zoning rules. In a region that's booming, those regulations hit on a lot of hot-button issues that we'll shortly get to. The district last fully revised its zoning rules in 1958. Joining us to discuss how it will affect the look and feel of the city is Roger Lewis, the architect who writes the Shaping the City column for the Washington Post, and he's Professor Emeritus of Architecture at the University of Maryland College Park. Hi, Roger. How's it going?
Very well, thank you.
One of the more contentious changes, parking requirements. I wanted to get to the specifics early because people are really interested in parking requirements. This is an area which generates a lot of debate. What's changing about parking regulations?
The basic proposed change is to reduce the parking requirements, the on-site requirements, in those areas well served by transit. And this is, of course...
We're talking about apartment buildings here.
Well, apartment buildings and commercial buildings. I mean, it's not limited to housing. And the notion is this is a smart growth strategy. Essentially, you want to incentivize people to use transit instead of driving everywhere. And there are places in the city, many places in the city, where that option exists, where you don't have to have a car. And it's particularly appropriate where increasing numbers of millennials are, in fact, choosing not to buy a car.
800-433-8850 is the number to call. Do you think it's a good idea to require fewer parking spaces for buildings near public transportation? 800-433-8850. You can send email to kojo@wamu.org. Shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to kojoshow.org, our website. Ask a question, make a comment there. Joining us in studio is Cheryl Court. She is the Policy Director for the Coalition for Smarter Growth, which promotes walkable, inclusive, and transit-oriented communities. Cheryl, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
You see parking minimums as one of the more significant of the changes coming. You say developers in some cases were having to build more parking than needed. Talk about that.
That's absolutely the case. We see that in areas that are well served by transit that are very walkable.
Oh, boy, and the Adams Morgan USA Mall, is that what that mall is called?
Right.
Adams Morgan
is
way too much parking.
We tremendously overbuilt parking in DC USA. We said at the time that we thought that was really a mistake, and so we're now living with the sunk costs there. But the city has really done the right thing in terms of adopting significant reductions in parking requirements near metro and major bus lines. And so we see that as a huge benefit to the city. There's many people who don't need to have a car to live here. And in fact, I mean, as all sorts of alternatives to individual car ownership become increasingly popular, there's less and less reason for many more people not to own a car.
Roger, these new zoning rules also expand the downtown area. What does that mean, and why does it matter?
I'm going to defer to Cheryl on that. I mean, the downtown area is, we know, is essentially negotiable. I mean, defining where it is, but I think the notion is that there are places near what we think of as the traditional downtown that, in fact, could have higher density because they are walkable, because there are services there that allow it to be thought of as downtown or central business district.
Sure.
Well, the downtown area has been expanded, and that was not particularly controversial, actually, even though that's the only place where the city actually zeroed out a parking requirement at all. And I know there is a lot of parking downtown, so a regulation is not telling developers to build a lot of parking. They're building a lot of parking anyway. The downtown has been expanded. There was a little bit of pushback on some of the kind of downtown-like parking standards for the West End neighborhood, so they kind of trimmed that back. But other than that, it was pretty uncontroversial to look at places where the city really can have a bigger downtown and behave like a downtown.
Still can't ride your bicycle on the sidewalk, though, downtown.
Well, we hope to get much better bicycling facilities throughout downtown and the rest of the city.
Joining us in studio now is Martin Ostermuhl. He's a web producer and a reporter for WAMU. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Corner stores, what's going on there, and how might that affect some residential neighborhoods?
Well, I mean, if you've been to parts of, let's say, Capitol Hill, the residential areas, you'll notice that there are some really cute little corner stores along, like, East Capitol Street. Now, a lot of those were when the zoning code was originally written back in the late 50s, and they were essentially grandfathered in. But since then, it's been very difficult, if not downright impossible, to open a corner store in most residential neighborhoods. And lots of folks started saying, well, you know, if you want to walk down the street, if you want to go buy a gallon of milk or buy some, like, basics for your house, you shouldn't have to get in a car and drive to your local supermarket or even jump on the metro. You should be able to go to a local corner store. So under this new zoning rewrite, in two residential zones, which is R3 and R4, those are, like, row house districts, that sort of stuff, parts of Petworth, Columbia Heights, Bloomingdale, Capitol Hill, it'll be easier to open a corner store. Now, they've limited the amount of corner stores and when they can open and that sort of thing, but it will now be possible for corner stores to pop up in residential neighborhoods.
Okay, now that you know a few of the specifics, you know what you can call about. 800-433-8850. Would you like to see more corner stores in residential areas? Roger, as we said, these zoning rules have not been fully overhauled in more than 50 years. Why has it taken so long to tackle this?
I'm sorry, the former mayor isn't here to talk about that. I think zoning is very politicized. I mean, it just inevitably involves a lot of inertia. There's a lot of resistance to changing it. There have been some tweaks to the zoning ordinance in the past 50 years. But I think that going back to Cheryl's point a few minutes ago, the things have changed. The city is not the same city that it was 50 years ago. So I think a lot of this is making the zoning ordinance fit circumstances of the 21st century. And I think that's probably the primary justification that times have changed.
Martin, when the code was written in 1958, this was also a very different city.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking now about how much the district is growing, but this city actually had more residents then. Can you talk about that and how these zoning changes address the need for more housing?
Right. So back in 1958, that's when the city had 800,000 people. It was the biggest it had ever been. It lost population from that point on, and it only started picking back up in the last, you know, decade or 15 years. But the point was that back in the day, more people lived in every single house in the district. There were just bigger families. There were more families. So you could fit more people in the existing housing stock, essentially. They're saying nowadays you have a lot more single folks. You have a lot of childless couples. You have maybe families that don't all want to cram into one house. So to get the same sort of density and population that you had back then, you just have to build more housing. You have to get more creative uses of what you have. And so, you know, you want to let people rent out basements or use basements or garages or carriage houses, build more buildings, that sort of stuff. So they're essentially saying we're growing again, but people are living more in separate units, so we need to build more units to fit them all.
Sure, Court, we may have fewer residents overall than we did in 1958, but the city is, well, booming. And one of the biggest issues in the district right now is the supply of housing. Prices are high and rising, and that's where zoning and public policy can apparently help. Can you
Absolutely.
Talk about that?
Yeah, I wanted to mention that inclusionary zoning, which is a zoning rule that gives developers increase in the number of units that they can build on the site to offset the cost of building some additional more affordable units, was adopted a number of years ago, and we're actually going back on March 3rd to the Zoning Commission to try to improve it so that it really is producing truly affordable units. Right now, it was too conservative a policy. It's too high at income level. That's really not serving the people it was intended to serve.
800-433-8850. Before I go to the phones, Roger, I'd just like to talk a little bit more broadly about affordability. Our region, among the most expensive housing markets in the country, new zoning aims to address this, including accessory housing. What exactly is accessory housing, and what will these zoning changes mean going forward?
I love the term the Australians invented, granny flats, for accessory housing. Accessory housing essentially is enabling or allowing accessory housing means enabling a property owner to have an additional dwelling unit. It might be a very small 300 or 400 square foot apartment. It might be something slightly larger that might be within the building. It might be over the top of a garage. It might be facing an alley, which would essentially allow another occupant, which could be grandmother, it could be a tenant.
Some parts of the country, they call them in-law apartments.
Oh, yeah, there are lots of names. And it is, as I think Martin just pointed out, it's a way of getting back to a density, a sustainable density. And it's more importantly, it provides and it provides services or some amenities for people who actually own the sponsoring house, because it might be someone who takes care of kids in that household. But it does provide an affordable housing option. I mean, because it would, what we have here is a problem of building housing, new housing that's affordable without adequate subsidy. You cannot build affordable housing, truly affordable, for the bottom of the demographic pyramid without subsidy. We don't have a whole lot of money for subsidy. So accessory dwellings are one of the ways of providing some housing that we otherwise couldn't provide.
Cheryl, you're in favor of allowing more accessory apartments. How much do these changes help, and how does D.C. compare to nearby jurisdictions, many of which have also updated their zoning?
Well, D.C. comes out on top in terms of the liberalizing its accessory apartments rules. Montgomery County adopted a rule a couple of years ago that's pretty good. It still kind of has some administrative procedures a part of it, but they're getting a positive response, and I think more accessory apartments coming in for approvals than they originally thought. Arlington did something much more conservative and really limited the number of accessory apartments. So D.C. is really doing the right thing by bringing accessory apartments into our single-family and sort of very low-density residential neighborhoods, which actually makes up the largest landmass in the city, even though it's not where most people live, to help to kind of diversify and get the mutual benefit of accessory apartments in those
there neighborhoods. There are some exceptions, though. Talk about the Georgetown exclusion and how something like that comes about.
Well, Georgetown sort of stands out it ended up being sort of a separate process. One thing that Office of Planning offered to communities around the city was creating sort of tailored zones for individual neighborhoods and sort of engaging with particularly well-organized neighborhood associations and community groups to put together something that's specific to that neighborhood. And so in the case of Georgetown, they went through a pretty elaborate community engagement process, and they sort of ended up with doing one thing for accessory apartments, not making them as a matter of right something that you could just go get a permit for, but actually continue to have a more elaborate approval process, something that we wanted to move away from in order to encourage homeowners to go ahead and put in accessory apartments.
On to the telephones. Here is Tom in Northwest Washington. Tom, thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo, and Mr. Lewis and Ms. Court and Mr. Ostermill. I remember that at the end of Jim Graham's tenure, he became concerned about what he was hearing from people who were just getting wind of how massive these changes were going to be. And he held a public forum, and it was standing room only. And people, you know, within 10 minutes were horrified for a ton of reasons, and you've mentioned only some of them. You know, this is a huge change, and albeit Mr. Lewis and Ms. Court might gloss over a lot of it, the fact is that, you know, they're driving headlong to cram a ton more people into residential neighborhoods. We're not talking NoMa with high rises, but you spend a ton of money on a townhouse, and you come home and you want to sit in your backyard, and now your backyard is walled in, and there are people over you in new apartments and stuff. Lot coverage and lot densities are all changing. So many things. But what came out of it ultimately was the strong vein of developer-centric changes. You know, like this was going to be great for developers. How curious.
And your point, Tom, is that this is not necessarily going to be good for residents?
Oh, not at all. And most of it, much of it, I should say. And it's not surprising, though, considering the inherent conflict of interest that is in the governmental process or the structure that governs this now.
So you think the developers are driving this process, and exactly what would you like one of our panelists to respond to?
Well, I would like them to respond particularly to the idea of breaking back out, as it once was, and not so long ago was, breaking back out the Office of Planning and the Office of Historic Preservation out from under the Deputy Mayor for Economic Development, which is, you know, a great...
I don't know how we accomplished that, but as I said, we don't have a great deal of time left, so I'm going to direct it to Cheryl Court.
Well, first of all, I mean, there is not a massive change coming out of the zoning update. It was a very moderate 8-year process that ended up with some very positive changes, but nothing like what you've characterized. And in fact, there was a very quick downzoning of middle density residential neighborhoods in the middle of this eight-year-long process.
Well, we got an absolutely opposite kind of email from Bill, who says, I live up on 16th Street on the park, and I absolutely love where I live, but it's just my wife and myself, and it's absolutely obscene that we live in 6,000 square feet with just the two of us. It seems that the zoning should at least allow for, when possible, cutting up some of these large houses, which is precisely what the zoning.
Well, I think I'd look at least putting an accessory apartment into your big house.
I mean, for 6,000 square feet, I'll come live in your place. I mean, there's a lot of room.
Well, one of the things that I suspect our caller Tom is upset about, Martin, is pop-up maps the real issue for many people right. living in neighborhoods with primarily single-family row houses is when a neighbor or a developer adds one or more floors to the building, creating two, three, or sometimes more condos. Why have these pop-ups become such a hot-button issue?
So the pop-ups weren't even actually, they weren't really part of this whole zoning rewrite. They were a separate move. The Zoning Commission, I think it was last year, maybe the year before, last year, they voted to basically restrict how high a house can go in a row house neighborhood and how far back on the lot it can go and basically how many units you can carve out of an existing row house. So they effectively made it impossible for developers to build pop-ups or made it significantly more difficult. And, you know, one of the complaints I'd heard from people on the opposite side of the debate is, listen, the zoning rewrite was great and good, but it didn't do enough to allow more housing to be built because as more people are coming to the city and they're looking for their own units, they need somewhere to live. And look, we may hate how pop-ups look. It might be jarring to the eye and to our sense of kind of like what we know of the district's history and architecture, but you can still fit more people in there. And by essentially passing the zoning rewrite, but at the same time restricting pop-ups, you've made it not a whole lot easier to add more people and add more housing units and, you know, potentially bring the price of housing down.
Roger, in June of last year, the District Zoning Commission approved new rules that address these pop-ups. Regulations now limit row house heights to 35 feet from a previous limit of 40 feet. The look and character of a neighborhood comes up a lot when we talk about zoning. Can you talk about that and what role zoning plays?
Well, I've always believed that zoning was at best a very crude sort of chainsaw approach to urban design and architecture. I mean, most zoning ordinances are dedicated primarily to constraining or limiting things. And so, in a way, I think one of the things that we're talking about here is an approach where a kind of form-based approach to zoning, some of us advocate, because most zoning ordinances are actually pretty mute when it comes to saying this is what we really want things to look like. I think that I want to underscore what Cheryl said a little while ago. I mean, the zoning changes, in my opinion, that are being proposed are tweaks, are characterized as they're minor. I think this notion that allowing, for example, an accessory apartment or dwelling is a developer motivated initiative is just a totally bogus argument. Most of these would be built probably by the owner of the property, or would be contracted through the ownership. So we could talk for an hour about zoning and its failures and what it doesn't do. But I think that what is happening, what's being proposed now in the District of Columbia is subtle. It's minor in its impact. It's not going to change the city as much as people think. And I think a lot of people are worried more about losing their parking spaces than they are about the impact on the
road. A lot of people want to talk about parking. I'll go to a couple of them. Mitya, can you be as brief as possible? We're running out of time.
Yes, I can. Thank you for having me on the show. I live on Tilden, and I'm surrounded by apartment buildings, which are occupied mostly by people, young people who work, and they don't have parking permits. Now, I have a parking permit, so I actually pay for being here on the street parking because I don't have off-street parking. But lots of these people don't have. Now, I'm sympathetic to more public transport, etc., I'm paying, and they're not, and I can't park. So that seems to be not in balance.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. We got a tweet from Jesu who says, what does DC have against cars? When your public transit is as subpar as DC's is, cars are necessary. Why not build parking garages? And then there is Rob in Westminster, Maryland. Rob, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hello?
Hi, Rob. You're on the air.
Hey, so just to give you a little bit of background, I actually went to school at just recently graduated from the University of College Park and had my studying in civil and environmental engineering and particularly sustainable development classes at the school. And, you know, when we talk about reducing the parking restrictions, I think it can really be a great step forward for...
Rob, we can't hear you very clearly. Your phone is not very clear, but the bottom line point that Robin wants to make is that he thinks that the parking zoning regulations that we have come up with is a really good idea. But we're almost out of time. Cheryl, we obviously have conflicting pressures in the district at the moment. We need more housing, but many homeowners are unhappy with the speed of development changing their neighborhoods. How do we move forward?
Well, the zoning rewrite is actually really helpful in terms of reducing parking requirements so that we can stop burdening apartment buildings that have plenty of people who would like to live there with not a lot of parking. So it's actually a really important advance.
We got an email from Derek. What is the forecast of the rising development of efficiency apartments in Washington, D.C.?
We are seeing some micro apartments going up at, 300 square feet.
Vincent Lawrence wants micro houses.
Well, I mean, the fact is that D.C. has a tremendous number of individual single-person households, and more than most any other part of the country, and folks need places to live, and this is a good solution for them.
Cheryl Court is the policy director for the Coalition for Smarter Growth, which promotes walkable, inclusive, and transit-oriented communities. Cheryl, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Martin Ostermuhl is a web producer and reporter for WAMU. Martin, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Roger Lewis is the architect who writes the Shaping the City column for the Washington Post. He's also professor emeritus of architecture at the University of Maryland College Park. Roger, thank you for joining
us. As always, thank you.
And thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
WAMU 88.5 is your listener-supported NPR news station in the greater Washington, D.C. region. You can support the Kojo Namdi Show and all the regional coverage you value by becoming a member today. Click the donate button at WAMU.org, and thanks.